Over the past 10 years or so, I was looking back at different topics that I've covered on the Day of Atonement, things like our journey from estrangement to reconciliation with God, Satan's devices, curtailing certain Satan's influence in our lives, proclaiming liberty. Of course, that's part of what the Day of Atonement pictures as well. The importance of mind, the importance of striving to think more like God, to become more like Him. In that sense, to be kind of soulmates with God and His way of thinking. But over the past couple of months, you know, it has seemed appropriate to speak a little more on prophetic topics. You may have noticed more of those in my messages of late, particularly end time prophecies. So I'd like to start today in the book of Revelation, chapter 20. We already read that, but we're going there anyway. It's amazing how overlapped things can be sometimes, but we'll read this again. We read it in the sermonette. It talks about an angel in verse 1, that I saw an angel, Revelation 21, coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit with a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit. And shut him up and set a seal on him so that he could deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. Now, I will admit, as a preteen and then as a teen, somehow I got wrapped up in the trying to imagine what a chain would be like that would hold Satan, trying to imagine what kind of lock, what kind of key, how do you come up with a bottomless pit? You know, I was kind of focused on the material, physical aspects of that. But as I got a little bit older, I realized, you know, that's not the point of it. That part is imagery. That part is not that important. What's important is what happens to him. And in the church, we've taught over the years, over the decades, that this is picturing the Day of Atonement, picturing Satan being bound. The Day of Atonement pictures and emphasizes reconciliation with God. And that can't really take place for all of the world until Satan is out of the way. Earlier in the book, in chapter 12, we're told that Satan is the great deceiver. Verses 9 and 10, Revelation 12, 9, beginning there, it says, "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." So we're told that Satan deceives the whole world. He is a master at deception. And we see in verse 10, "Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down." So we see two major things that Satan's involved in. One is deception, blinding, hiding, deceiving the whole world. And secondly is accusing the people of God, you and me, before God. Every chance he gets, he will accuse us before God. It says here day and night. And of course, day and night have no relevance to God in the spirit realm. It does to us quite a bit. But again, constantly, just means constantly, he's there trying to accuse us before God. We read another aspect of Satan's involvement when we read what Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Let's turn there. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. We have the imagery of several different things involving Satan. The broadcasting, as we heard in the sermonette. Here's another aspect of it in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I'm going to start in verse 1. It actually goes through verse 4, this passage that I want to read. But 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 1, "Therefore," he says, "since we have this ministry, as we have received mercy, we do not lose heart. But we have renounced the hidden things of shame, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is in the image of God, should shine on them." So we have here this image of a veil, imagery of things being hidden, being covered, that Satan yes, he deceives, but he also hides. He covers the truth so that people can't discover it. Paul was saying that Satan is using that veil to keep the light of the true gospel from shining to the people of the world, those who were not being called at that time. And Paul says those people are perishing. They're perishing. They've not received the true mercy that he and the others who understand God's plan and have been given that wonderful blessing, he and the other ministers have received. In the next chapter, Paul talks about, explains his whole job as a minister. Is in one sense a job of reconciliation, of trying to help people come to be reconciled with God. In chapter 5, my Bible is across the page, verses 18 through 20. He says, "Now all things are of God, who has reconciled us to himself through Jesus Christ, and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not imputing their trespasses to them, and has committed to us the word of reconciliation. Now then, we're ambassadors for Christ, as though God were pleading through us. We implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God." So again, here, the clear intent of this, Paul is saying, that's in one sense my whole ministry, is to reconcile people to God, to reconcile everyone, for them to be able to see the truth, to those who are not blinded, that they can build that relationship with God. So these are things that we all put together to be a part of this understanding of Revelation 20, that binding of Satan involves all of this. I'd like to walk through a little bit how we know that what Paul was explaining here in 2 Corinthians is what the Day of Atonement is about. I mean, we've looked at this many times in the past, but I'd like to walk through a few things about that, and to point out why we connect Revelation 20 to the Day of Atonement. If you look at commentaries, they don't make that connection at all. Most of modern Christianity doesn't see it. They don't get it. It doesn't make sense to them. But we see Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3, as depicting literally events that relate to this feast called Atonement. How do we refute what people who don't believe that? Right. Well, we'll get to that a little bit later. But first, let's take a look at what this Feast of Atonement that's coming up on Monday, what it pictures. The first time we find the word atone or atonement in Scripture is actually in Exodus. It's in Exodus 29, where Moses was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. You remember that? God was giving him a lot of detailed instructions. He gave him instructions about how to build the tabernacle, exactly how to build every part of it, the altar, clothing for the priests, a ceremony to inaugurate the priesthood, Moses, or Aaron, rather, and the priests. Moses was to offer a bull as a sin offering and a ram as a burnt offering. You get to Exodus 29. And there was also a ram as a consecration offering. In other words, to say, this is for the priesthood. And let's pick it up in verse 29. Exodus 29 in verse 29. It says, "And the holy garments of Aaron shall be his sons after him, to be anointed in them and to be consecrated in them." Consecrated, set apart, given a special job to serve God and to serve God's people, ancient Israel, on God's behalf. Verse 30, "That son who becomes priest in his place shall put them on for 7 days when he enters the tabernacle of meeting to minister in the holy place. And you shall take the ram of the consecration and boil its flesh in the holy place. Then Aaron and his son shall eat the flesh of the ram and the bread that is in the basket by the door of the tabernacle of meeting. They shall eat those things with which the atonement was made to consecrate and to sanctify them. But an outsider may not eat it because they're holy." So those things that were done were a matter of atonement. They were atoning. They were to make the priesthood right. The Hebrew word kapar, lexicons say it means to cover, to purge, to make an atonement for, to spiritually purify. So this was for the priesthood, to make reconciliation with them. So first the priest had to be reconciled to God, and then they were able to serve God's people. In the next chapter, in chapter 30, God gave Moses instructions about the altar. Let's take a look there. And notice verse 10, one of the things that he said about the altar that was to be made. Exodus 30 and verse 10, "And Aaron shall make atonement upon its horns once a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonement. Once a year he shall make atonement upon it through your generations. It is most holy to the Lord." And we know that there's a whole passage that talks about the ceremony that Aaron was supposed to go through, that the priesthood was supposed to go to on the day of atonement, with the two goats, the one that was sacrificed as a sin offering and the other that was let go. The sins of the nation were confessed over that goat, and it was to be set free to wander in the wilderness. But Aaron was to make atonement once a year. This was on the Day of Atonement, that he was to make that atonement on the horns of the altar. There was protrusions on the corners of the altar. There's a passage in Leviticus that mentions this being done in once a year. And two chapters later, after the sin with the golden calf, notice Moses used this same Hebrew word for atonement in chapter 32. After the people had sinned, Moses had come back down the mountain. We can go to verse 30. It says, "Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses said to the people, 'You have committed a great sin. So now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin.'" Again, this covering, this reconciling you to God. That this will cover your sin. It will put you back to be at one with God, to reconcile you with God, to put you in a good relationship again with God. So we see early on, even in the book of Exodus, the word atonement being used to reconcile people, to reconcile the priesthood, to reconcile the children of Israel, to bring them into a right relationship with God. So let's go to Leviticus 23 now. In Leviticus 23, we find all of the feasts of God listed. And one of the things that we have mentioned over and over is in verse 2, that these are the feasts of the Lord. They're God's feast. So many people today want to call them the feasts of Israel or the feasts of the Jews. But Leviticus 23 and verse 2, "Speak to the children of Israel," God speaking to Moses, says, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts.'" I find it interesting that not only did he say, "These are the feasts of the Lord," but he also used the word "my." They're my feasts. Twice in the same verse, he emphasized, "These are his. They don't belong to anyone else. And they're not things that he just told them to do. These are things that he put his name in. These are things that he says belong to him. These are his festivals. It's the feast of God." We go down to verse 27 and we find the information about what we're going to do on Monday, on the Day of Atonement. Verse 27, "Also the 10th day of this 7th month shall be the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you, and you shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. You shall do no work on that day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people. And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statue forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls on the 9th day of the month at evening, from evening to evening. You shall celebrate your Sabbath." So God's very specific about what we're to do on this day, that we're to afflict our souls. That's mentioned three times. It's very important to God that we do this, that we afflict ourselves. The Hebrew word means to abase or to weaken or to humble ourselves. Going without food for 24 hours, evening to evening, from the start of the day to the start of the next day, usually leaves us feeling a little weak, doesn't it? Feeling a little abased, feeling, reminds us how much we need as human beings. We are needy beings, aren't we? Not only do we need air, we need that all the time, but we need food, we need water, we need some shelter. And when we think about what all we need, it's supposed to remind us that God doesn't need any of that. He has no need whatsoever for any of those things. Doesn't need air, doesn't need food, doesn't need water, doesn't need shelter. He doesn't need anything. Really, he doesn't need us. He wants us. He wants us in his family, but he doesn't need us. He doesn't need anything, and yet we are so incredibly needy. We're going to follow the sermonette and go to James 4 also, so, to take a look at this affliction. As we afflict ourselves, how did James use it? If we're fasting, what is that supposed to do for us? Well, fasting should remind us of who and what we are. James 4 and verse 7, therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your mourning to joy. Humble yourselves, verse 10, in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. So draw near to God, lament and mourn, and humble yourself. Fasting is supposed to help us resist Satan. Humbling ourselves helps us resist Satan. When we resist Satan in the attitude of pride that he initiated, and we don't find any reference to pride among any other of the spirit beings prior to Lucifer, he initiated and he exudes that attitude of pride. When we draw close to God, Satan flees. But you know, Satan's kind of a persistent being. When he flees, he doesn't necessarily stay gone, does he? He checks back from time to time to see if we have lost a little bit of that humility, if we've begun to let that fade. That's why it's so important for us to make sure we remain humble and not lose that. You know, once we eat and drink again, we begin to revive a little bit, don't we, physically speaking. And it's interesting that when we have our needs met, it's a whole lot easier for us to become prideful. Satan wants to know whether we've let that pride build up again. I don't think we as Christians really understand how much pride is a part of Satan's way of influencing us and trying to pull us away from God. You know, we humans can be proud of all kinds of things. Some of them kind of ridiculous if you think about it. But we can be proud of all kinds of stuff. We can be proud of our age, whether it's young or old. We can be proud of our looks, our strength. We can be proud of our thoughts, our opinions, our possessions, our importance. Lots of things. You know, for puny, weak physical beings, it's amazing how full of pride we can be. It's what Satan allowed to happen. We are insignificant in comparison to God and in comparison to the universe, to the earth for that matter. And yet we can become very prideful. In fact, we can even become proud of fasting. Remember in the Old Testament? Well, first of all, let's go to one in the New Testament that Jesus mentioned in Luke 18 of an individual who was proud of the fact that he fasted a lot. He obviously was missing the point, wasn't he? Missed the point by a mile. Luke 18. It begins in verse 9. It says, also he, speaking of Jesus Christ, spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous, there's the pride, and despised others. And here's what he said. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed with himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Again, pride. Pride's defined as a high or an inordinate opinion of one's own dignity, merit, importance, or superiority. And that's the attitude we see this Pharisee praying with himself. I like the way Jesus said that. He wasn't really praying to God, was he? He was praying to himself. Puffing himself up. And one of the things that Jesus said he was proud about was his fasting. I fast twice a week. Again, he missed the point. Even fasting can be a source of pride if we don't do it properly. It's not done correctly. And of course, I think we're familiar with Isaiah 58 because that's what we're told back there in Isaiah's statement about fasting in this chapter. He writes quite a bit, actually, about fasting. Beginning in verse 1 of Isaiah 58, it says, cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet. Tell my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinances of justice. They take delight in approaching God. Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen? Why have we afflicted our souls and you take no notice? In fact, in the day of your fast, you find pleasure and exploit all your laborers. Indeed, you fast for strife and debate and to strike with a fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush and to spread out sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast and an acceptable day to the Lord? I mean, this was a common practice among ancient Israelites. God said, yeah, they're fasting. You fast regularly. And then you wonder why you don't get any response, why it doesn't do any good. And he says, well, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. You're fasting to make your opinion, your ideas, your will known to me. You're fasting to try to force me to do things. You're fasting for strife and debate. Verse 6, he says, is this not the fast that I've chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry? And that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out. When you see the naked, that you cover him, and you not hide yourself from your own flesh. Obviously, these must have been things that the Israelites were doing wrong, weren't doing correctly. And God mentions each of these. Then he says, verse 8, your light will shine forth like the morning. Your healing will spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You'll cry, and he will say, here I am. If you take away the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger and the speaking wickedness, if you extend your soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then your light shall dawn as the darkness, and your darkness shall be as the noonday. Again, they obviously missed the point in what they were doing. God said, do it the right way. Do it with the right approach, the right attitude, and you'll get the right outcome. All they got was hungry and thirsty. Misguided idea that they'd done something great. You know, you think about this. The idea that you can force God to do what you want, I mean, if that's not an arrogant thing for us puny human beings to do, I don't know what is. We can force God to do something. You know, his thoughts, his ways are always higher than ours. He says that. He tells us they're above ours. And he does what he decides, not what we decide. Now, we can ask for things, and Jesus did say, if you want, ask. Ask in my name. But we don't fast to force God to do anything. they miss the whole point. The point is to humble ourselves, to be yielded to God's will, whatever God's will may be. And God's will sometimes will match up with ours. And when His doesn't, His is the will we need to go with, not ours. And sometimes that's a difficult thing for us to figure out in our minds, isn't it? Sometimes we struggle with that. We have to be humble, yielded to God's will and to His desire. Now, not all of the fasting in the Old Testament was wrong. We do have some positive examples, too. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 7. I want to show that there was an understanding of a right way to do things. And it's interesting, in 1 Samuel chapter 7, Samuel was able to inspire the people to use fasting as a way of changing. Didn't change God, but it changed them. It made changes in their life. I think this is a good point for us to think about, that what God is looking for from us in fasting is that it changes us. It changes our attitude. It changes us to be more in line with His attitude. We heard some things in the sermonette about the things that we should be pursuing, things that are more of God, not the works of the flesh, but the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, meekness, faith, self-control, those things. Well, let's read this example in the Old Testament here in 1 Samuel chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. It says, "Then the men of Kirjath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated Eleazar his son to keep the ark of the Lord. And so it was that the ark remained at Kirjath-Jearim a long time. It was there 20 years. And all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. And then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, 'If you return to the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtoreths from among you, and prepare your hearts for the Lord, and serve Him only, and He will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines.' So the children of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtoreths, and served the Lord only. And Samuel said, 'Gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you.' So they gathered together at Mizpah, drew water, poured it out before the Lord, and they fasted that day, and said there, 'We have sinned against the Lord.' And Samuel judged the children of Israel at Mizpah. Now when the Philistines heard that the children of Israel had gathered together at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the children of Israel heard it, they were afraid of the Philistines. So the children of Israel said to Samuel, 'Do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that He may save us from the hand of the Philistines.' And Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. And as Samuel was offering the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel, but the Lord thundered with a loud thunder upon the Philistines that day, and so confused them that they were overcome before Israel." God responded, didn't He? In a very powerful, very visible, very audible, I should say, way, by defeating the Philistines. I find it interesting in verse 13, it says, "So the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come any more into the territory of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel." But see, at Samuel's urging, the people did the right thing. They humbled themselves. And in that humbling of themselves, they repented. They recognized the need to change their thinking and to change their acting, their actions. And God helped them in a very powerful way. Again, the key to the story is in verse 6, where it says they fasted and where they repented. They changed. Isaiah 29, let's go to the statement in Isaiah. Isaiah 29 and verse 13. So ancient Israel was very good at saying the right things. You might remember even at Mount Sinai when Moses confirmed the covenant with Israel, told them all the things that God wanted them to do. All the people said, "Yes, we'll do that. We'll do that. Sounds great." God said, "What they say is right. Oh, that they had a heart in them, that they would do what they say." Well, ancient Israel was pretty bad about doing that, saying the right thing, but not doing it. Isaiah 29 and verse 13, this was one of the things God had against Israel at that time. Therefore the Lord said, inasmuch as these people draw near me with their mouths and honor me with their lips, but have removed their hearts far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the commandment of men. Therefore I'll do a marvelous work against this people, a marvelous work and a wonder. And God said, humans, we get so easily distracted. And ancient Israel got so easily distracted. The ceremony, the ritual. Yes, they were the right things to do, but they didn't change the inside. Yes, God does want the outside. I mean, he wants us to meet on the Sabbath. He wants, you know, all the things that he tells us to do. He wants us to obey. But what he's really looking for is that to be backed up with what's inside. That what's inside is the same as what's outside. Jesus had a lot to say about that, about being whitened sepulchers. You say one thing, you look good on the outside, but the inside, it doesn't match up with what's on the outside. We've got to be genuine. It's very important that we do the right things that God asks us to do, but that has to be matched on the inside. We have to be focused on God with our hearts and our actions. And that's, to me, a big part of the message of atonement. Being in tune with God. Being in tune with our hearts, with the inside. That is a big part of this. Our thoughts and our deeds. Satan will, and he is doing, all he can to confuse God's people and to confuse any people to keep them from seeing the light of the truth. As he does with all of God's gospel message and God's plan of salvation. You know, we already read in 2 Corinthians how Paul talked about God removing the veil that Satan has cast over the nations. And Paul was elaborating on the statement in Isaiah 25. We're in the book of Isaiah. Let's go to chapter 25. He talked about a veil being over them. Paul didn't mention destroying that. It's this passage that talks about destroying that. But his imagery of Satan using this veil to keep the light of the gospel from coming to people, from them being able to see it, it comes from this passage, Isaiah chapter 25 and verses 6 and 7. We know this is a millennial setting by what we read about this. It says, and in this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of choice pieces. So God's going to make a feast for everyone, all people of the world. Right now, we don't see all people of the world observing the feast. A very small segment. I mean, they're just a tiny fragment of the population of this planet that keep the feasts of God. But at this time, when this takes place, after Christ's return, and when the kingdom of God is set up on this earth and Jesus is ruling here, he's going to make for all people a feast of choice pieces, a feast of wine on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of well-refined wine on the leaves. And he will destroy on this mountain the surface of the covering cast over all people and the veil that is spread over all nations. You know, Satan, again, has put this veil that keeps the light of God's truth from penetrating, from them being reconciled to God and by his deception and by blinding them to the truth of the Bible. You know, every time I read in Isaiah, that chapter 35, where it talks about healing, I think about this. I think about the physical aspect of it, and there are a lot of physical things that need healing in this world. But I think about this from the perspective of eyes. You can't see the light because Satan has this veil that he's cast over the nations. And when I read that chapter 35, let's turn there, to me, this is exactly the spiritual aspect that's being conveyed in this passage, as well as the physical aspect. Don't deny the physical. I look forward to that time when God will heal people of physical issues. But it's the spiritual healing as well that's going to be a wonderful part of the millennial setting. Chapter 35 of Isaiah, verse 1, says, the wilderness and the wasteland will be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It'll blossom abundantly. We know from other passages this is what God talks about in the millennium when Jesus Christ rules from Jerusalem and the saints are assisting him in re-educating the world. Skip down to verse 5. I won't read all of this, but skip down to verse 5. He says, then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. For waters will burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. We believe this to be literal, absolutely true in a physical sense. These things will happen physically. But I also see in this a figurative sense that is true, that God's going to remove that veil so eyes that previously couldn't see now can see the truth of God when it's taught to them from Jerusalem. Ears that used to not be able to really hear what God was trying to say and now will hear. They will understand. They'll perceive. And they'll recognize and understand what God is saying. He'll unstop those ears. People who will figuratively leap for joy and sing God's praises because they've come to understand the incredible plan that God has. The incredible future that God has for human beings. That he wants us to be a part of his family. You know, Paul in 1 Corinthians said, it hadn't even entered the heart of man what God has prepared for us. We as humans don't think that big quite often. God thinks big, and he does big to make us a part of his family, to let us inherit everything alongside Jesus Christ. That's pretty big. Can't think of anything bigger than that. So these are wonderful things that the Old Testament talks about, very clear passages in Scripture. And it's because of passages like this that when we come to Revelation 20, we say, yeah, that's what this is picturing. All of this supports that Revelation 20, Satan being bound, that he no longer has the ability to deceive people, that veil is destroyed that he has cast over people, the ears that he has stopped up, the eyes that he's blinded, they're going to hear, they're going to see that he's going to be bound and not allowed to deceive people. Turn back to Revelation 20 with me. Because what so many people see as, oh, just figurative, we see as literal. And when we look at the connection to all of the old, I know we read a few of the passages in the Old Testament that connect with this for the Day of Atonement. There's a whole ceremony with the two goats, and they go to that one. But it's very literal that one is pushed away and not allowed to have access to God's people. But we see this as Satan being bound. Verse 3, cast him in the bottomless pit, shut him up, set a seal on him so he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. You know, we see this as literal. A literal fulfillment of what the Day of Atonement pictures, of human beings being able to be reconciled with God. And as we go on and read a little bit more in this, he says, and I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and the Word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he that has part of the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. And when the 1,000 years is expired, Satan will be released from his prison. So all of this shows us that he's going to be locked away for 1,000 years and then let loose for a little bit. And it doesn't make sense. For those people who don't keep God's cycle of feasts, who believe that humans have this immortal soul that's living and conscious inside them, that the moment they die either goes to heaven or goes to hell to be punished, to be rewarded or punished, this doesn't make any sense. This idea of 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth and of this resurrection, why do you need to resurrect them if they're already there with God in heaven? It just doesn't make sense to them. You know, I never really thought a whole lot about how other people viewed the book of Revelation and this chapter in particular. Chapter 20 is a big problem to modern Christianity. Didn't really give it a whole lot of thought until, I guess it was the Feast of 94 that was really a big turning point for me. Many of you remember 1994. Some of you that have been around for a long time. My parents had some extra second tithe that year. Every few years, they would save up a little bit, and then they would take either my brother, or my sister, or me. They said, we want each of you to have a chance to go internationally to the feast, internationally somewhere. So 94 was our turn. The other two had already gone, Italy, and I forgot where the other one went. But anyway, 94, my parents said, hey, we can help you go overseas if you would like. Where do you want to go? Being 100% German on both sides, from what I know, from what I can tell of our genealogy, I said, Germany. I'd love to go to Germany. They said, well, okay, we've got a couple of sites to pick from. And I thought, well, Black Forest, you know, the southern part of Germany, it'd be a great place to go. So that's where we went, and we were able to go there. My parents helped us go there. We actually traveled a little bit around the area after the feast as well, and before. All of you that were in the church will know what was going on that year. I had been asking that summer questions. Living down on the coast, shrimp was a big deal. Crabs were a big deal. And South Louisiana. And I kept hearing rumors, you know, oh, they're going to change, they're going to change, they're going to change. And I kept asking ministerial services, oh, no, those are rumors. You know, we're not doing that. Ken, you know, settle down, calm down. No, we're not doing that. So I went to the feast, and we're at the feast, and the feast coordinator in the southern Germany gets up, and he talks about the book of Revelation, and he says, oh, by the way, you know, it's all just an allegory. It's just encouragement to us that in the end, we win. And you could have picked my jaw up off the floor, because I have been told over and over, no, these are just rumors, Ken. You know, we're not changing things. And here I was being told by this pastor who was coordinating the feast in Germany that, no, it's just an allegory. It's not really real. I was later told that he had already been attending a seminary school there in Germany. Well, I'll take a few minutes to explain to everyone, and maybe most importantly for some of our young adults who really weren't involved in that big earthquake, church quake, should we call it, in 1995, in the same way that many of us were. I want to share a few quotes. Edward Gibbon, in his book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, in chapter 15, he explained that belief in Christ's return followed by a literal millennium, a literal thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ. That was common among primitive Christians, but that eventually, over time, that was rejected. And their reasoning for rejecting it as invention, heresy, fanaticism, was they just thought, well, you know, those were primitive Christians. The word primitive is not meant to be flattering. It's meant to be insulting. Those are just primitive Christians, you know. They really didn't know that much. They were sincere, maybe, but simple-minded, not mature enough to know what we do. Barclay's Daily Study Bible on Revelation chapter 20. I looked at a lot of commentaries, but Barclay's Daily Study Bible says this. We note two general facts. I'm going to put the word facts in quotes. Two general facts. First, this was a very common belief in the early church, and it still has its adherents. Second, this is the only passage in the New Testament in which it is clearly taught. This doctrine does not occur anywhere else in the New Testament, but was a prevalent thought of the early church, especially among those who had received their Christianity from Jewish sources. So here's the key, you know, in his mind. Here's our key. The origin of this doctrine is not specifically Christian, but it's found in certain Jewish beliefs among the Messianic Age, about the Messianic Age, which were common at the time of about 100 B.C. So he dismisses all of Revelation 20 as simply Jewish fable, Jewish belief, Jewish aspirations. They wanted the Romans conquered. They wanted Jesus Christ to set up a kingdom. So this was Jewish dreams and desires. Barnes notes when he writes about the thousand years, he says this period could be literal. He said, well, it could be prophetic. Using a day for a year principle, that would be, what, 360 day for a year, 1,000 years, that'd be 360,000 years. He's just saying that's a way that you could look at it. And he says, or it could be figurative. And while acknowledging that there are literalists today, that's people like us who take this literally, that when God says 1,000, he means 1,000 years, he doubts that that's the correct interpretation because he gets confused when he reads other passages. The ones like Matthew 25 where the sheep and the goats are divided, Jesus just simply said there's going to be a time when the sheep and the goat, the sheep and goat are divided. So this can't be the right understanding. The belief that man has an immortal soul also is heavily ingrained in Barnes. The idea that why do you need a resurrection? And why do you need 1,000 years between the resurrection there and this resurrection you read later about the books opened and people judged? And it doesn't make any sense to him. He can't see how this fits with God's plan. One resurrection alone would be very difficult to comprehend, but two, I mean, that's doubly hard. How in the world do you square that with the idea of an immortal soul? Well, the truth is you don't, because there is no immortal soul in humans. See, Satan's veil blocks many of these. They're intelligent people, but it blocks them from being able to see the truth of God's plan. I could give you comments from other commentaries with similar kinds of views and reasoning, but I think that's enough to see that the ideas about the book of Revelation simply being an allegory or just being, it's a kind of an encouragement that we win in the end. I mean, that's the main teaching of modern Christianity. But that's what was beginning to find its way into the Worldwide Church of God and into the Feast Coordinator's sermon in Germany in 1994. Through men who were going to seminary schools to learn what Barnes and Barclay and other people thought about Revelation 20. And then they were beginning to believe that. You know, in 1995, early in 1995, my brother told me that they had their feast coordinators meeting. They usually did that. Now we do it after the feast, shortly after the feast. At that time, they were doing it early in the year, January, kind of gearing up for planning for the feast each year. And in early 1995 in January, he went to the feast coordinator's meeting in Pasadena, California. And he said at that meeting, one of the men who had been attending a local seminary got up and began explaining Revelation 20 exactly the way Barnes and these others do, and saying, you know, we can't preach anymore that the millennium is real and that the book of Revelation talks about the millennial reign of Christ for 1,000 literal years. And of course, it wasn't long after that when we left that organization, realizing the truth had left them. They had given it over. Let me give you a few reasons. That's what most of modern Christianity says. Let me give you a few reasons why we don't agree with that. Number one, I would begin by saying the primitive church, as they call it, I will say early Christians, I will say first century Christians, that's a little more accurate, that those early Christians, they were a whole lot closer to the source than these commentators are, I mean, than we are today. They were literally with Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, who taught them. Paul even says that he learned directly from Jesus Christ. Now, to me, that makes their practice, that makes their belief a whole lot more accurate than what people are doing thousands and thousands of years later. So I would say their belief in a literal 1,000 years is probably a lot more accurate. Secondly, Revelation 20, we don't have just one reference to the 1,000 years, but if you start looking at it, there are at least 6 different references in this chapter to the 1,000 years. And they're all referencing different aspects of that 1,000 years. Some has it to be with Satan being bound. There's another one that talks about him loosed, being loosed at the end of the 1,000 years. The 1,000 years has to do with the saints reigning, has to do with Jesus Christ reigning, has to do with what happens to people after that 1,000 years and another resurrection. Now, Barclay may, and others may want to just lump them all together. I mean, it's all in one chapter. This is the only place that's very, very clear about it. And that is true. It's the only one that's very, very clear. But we've always looked at the Bible as that was always saying it's not a matter of subtraction but of addition. We look at putting pieces of the puzzle together to get the full picture of what God is saying. And we see Revelation 20 as clarifying all of those things that I read in the Old Testament and all the ones I didn't read. That they clarify, they make them clear. They point out the time frame for all of those. I would also say the authorship of this book. Turn back to Revelation 1 with me. Who is the author of this information? It's not John. It's not one of the apostles. Revelation chapter 1 verse 1 says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God, as the Father, gave Jesus Christ to show his servants things which must shortly take place. So the author of this is Jesus Christ, which God gave him, the Father gave him. So I would say the authorship of this information is a whole lot more credible than any commentary you can read. The authorship is God himself. Do you really want to disparage the words of Jesus Christ and God the Father who gave this? Why would God the Father and Jesus Christ simply go along with some Jewish ideas or aspirations? That doesn't make any sense. That would be perpetuating a lie. God doesn't lie. We're told in Hebrews 6:18, I won't turn there, but it says it's impossible for God to lie. No, this isn't a lie. This is truth. This is the truth of God. In Revelation chapter 22, we have this warning at the very end that is specifically focused on this book, where it says in verses 18 and 19, for I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book, if anyone adds to these things, God will add to him the plagues that are written in this book. And if anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part from the book of life, from the holy city, and from the things which are written in this book. The good things, the positive things, the encouraging, the hopeful things that are written in this book. I mean, again, that's pretty serious. Don't mess with my book, God said. Don't try to edit my book. My words are my words. Accept them. Live by them. And of course, we realize the concept of Jesus Christ in chapter 20, reigning on earth, didn't begin with this book. It's all through the prophets of old, all through the Old Testament. There's scores of passages about the millennium and what it's going to be like. Revelation 20 just puts a time frame to it. It's the same thing that we find throughout the Old Testament that the prophets of old wrote about. So all of these reasons lead us to directly believe that what we read here in Revelation 20 and the whole book of Revelation, they are literal events that are going to take place. And the more we look around us today in our society and in our country and in our world, it seems that time is closer, much closer than it had been years ago. You know, in addition, by keeping the feasts of God, particularly the fall feast, we see a general timeline of events. But I wanted to go through that because, you know, if we don't learn the lesson of history, why do we believe what we believe? Why do we teach what we teach? It's good for us to remember that history, why we are where we are. And by keeping God's feasts, particularly these fall feasts, like I said, we have this timeline. We look at the spring feast, and yes, Passover is important for everybody, to have our sins forgiven, unleavened bread, our part of trying to work to put sin out, Pentecost and having the Holy Spirit to assist us in that job. But when we come to the fall, trumpets is that pivotal point. I mean, it points to so many things that change. Prophetic things. Yes, the day of the Lord. Yes, Jesus Christ's return. Yes, the resurrection of the saints, the first resurrection. All the different things that begin with that turning point. And then we have the Day of Atonement. Satan being bound, leading the way for people to be taught in the millennium about God's truth, and that veil being removed and Satan being removed so he can't continue to blind the eyes and plug up the ears. Tabernacles, Christ's kingdom being set up and people flowing to Jerusalem to be taught. And the last great day, All those deceived by Satan who've never had a chance for salvation, not lost. They come back to life. They have a chance for salvation. For whatever time period that is. They can accept or they can reject God's offer. Those are awesome, awesome things. So as we look at Revelation 20, those first three verses, I take great joy in reading these. I love looking at this passage and at this prophecy. There's a great angel. He laid hold, verse 2, of the dragon, that serpent of old, who's the devil and Satan, bound him 1,000 years, cast him into the bottomless pit, shut him up and set a seal on him, so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. As we keep the Day of Atonement on Monday, let's remember God is literally going to bind Satan. He will keep Satan from being able to deceive people. He will remove that veil that's cast over the nations. He will begin to reign through Jesus Christ and that job of re-education that we, hopefully, all will be a part of, that we will assist him in re-educating the world as his word begins to flow from Jerusalem. And mankind will be able to be reconciled to God. Those are wonderful, exciting, joyous things to look forward to.